From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, local government may get a helping hand from Lansing, a way to make up revenue lost with the end of the personal property tax.
It's a very, very convoluted tax that has lots of different formulas and stuff like that. So it's a bureaucratic nightmare, not only for the businesses, but for the communities.
The newly proposed Pentagon budget would take out an aircraft that is key to Michigan, but will it get past Congress?
Especially in an election year, it's hard to see Congress going along with any significant restructuring of the military.
Why Governor Snyder is on the right track for Michigan with his pro-immigration push.
Immigrants are an engine of economic development, and so we know that this is true whether or not they're filling some of our hard-to-fill jobs in the economy or whether they're starting businesses.
Those stories and more today. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for joining us on this very cold Wednesday. Well, as we know, Governor Snyder has proposed a plan to attract 50,000 highly skilled immigrants to the state. Well, some worry that we're not doing enough for the immigrants who are already here. We're going to talk about that on today's program. Then we all take shortcuts, don't we? Think about your walk to work or the store. Do you cut through a parking lot or cut across an empty field? Well, there's so much vacant land in Detroit. That is exactly what people are doing. So much so, you can see their tracks from Google Earth. Later in the hour, we'll explore Detroit's urban footpaths. But first, earlier this week, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel unveiled his latest budget proposal. It's clear that as the drawdown in Iraq and Afghanistan continues, the Obama administration's priority is now reducing military size and spending. For example, the active duty Army would shrink to its smallest level since just before America entered World War II. There would be base closings, troop cuts, trimming back salary increases, and completely eliminating several Air Force aircraft fleets, including the A-10. It's an aircraft that dates back to the Cold War. It's known as the Warthog, designed to take out Soviet tanks. 24 of America's 300 Warthogs are at Selfridge Air National Guard Base in Macomb County, and eliminating that fleet would be a gut punch to Selfridge. Here to explain is Detroit News Washington Bureau Chief David Shepherdson. Always good to talk with you, David. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So overall, what has been the reception from Congress to the new budget?
You know, not surprisingly, fairly negative. You know, this airplane and Selfridge's planes in particular have been targeted by the Pentagon for close to 5 years now. And the Senate Armed Services Committee and the House have repeatedly rejected those cuts, you know, with prominent legislators from Michigan. In fact, the entire congressional delegation has written repeated letters defending the A-10s. And I think it's for a couple of reasons. One, you know, Michigan has a relatively small military footprint in terms of active duty personnel, and was certainly a very hard hit by the base closures back in the 80s and early 90s.
Yes.
So I think that's another reason why the state, both the Republican governor and the entire delegation, is so protective of these planes.
It is kind of, to be very objective, you know, we're talking about a Cold War relic that I'm sure that have had chronic repair costs. If we were to step away from what it might mean to Southeast Michigan to lose this at Selfridge, can a case be made for what the Pentagon wants to do in getting rid of these?
Former Defense Secretary Bob Gates just came out with a new memoir about a month ago and talked about how one of the things he hated most about being Defense Secretary was that every member of Congress would come up to him, and no matter how small, no matter how parochial, would, you know, try to convince him not to make any cuts in their districts. And that's one of the reasons that the Defense Department and the military complex is so large. I mean, you know, for most major vehicle plane production spread out all over the country, you know, in almost every state, there's some part or component made. And so, yeah, I mean, that's the rub here. Mm. You have a Defense Department that has seen its budget explode and is looking for places to cut. I mean, case in point, just a couple months ago, the Congress passed a 1% reduction in cost of living increases. Now, remember, that's not a that's not a reduction. It's just a reduction in the amount of increases going forward.
Right.
Yet there was so much of an outcry that they reversed it for a very small cut. So I think everything is going to be incredibly difficult for cuts to be made, and especially in an election year, it's hard to see Congress going along with any significant restructuring of the military.
How much does Secretary Hagel believe could be saved by eliminating the A-10 fleet?
You know, I have not seen a specific number, but when you're talking about a fair number of airplanes, I mean, if you add up the cost of servicing these vehicles, it's certainly in the billions of dollars across the board, not to mention all the personnel involved. But, you know, the defenders will point out of the A-10, yes, it was a Cold War plane, but these planes have been used in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and, you know, where they were protecting troops in harm's way. But you're right. On the other hand, the Air Force says, hey, those planes could be, could be replaced with F-16s, the future F-35. And a lot of people say, hey, the A-10 has sort of has lost its luster in terms of some of the future planes.
And it is worth noting that the proposed defense budget has some kind of good news for the Battle Creek Air National Guard base, because they found out last year they were going to be home to the MQ-9 Reaper. That's a drone. And it seems very clear that even as Secretary Hagel wants to get rid of Cold War relics like the Warthog, he is ready to boost spending on drones.
That, and don't forget that the Selfridge also was home to the KC-135 air refueling tanker, and that there was when they initially made this proposal to transfer a couple of years ago the A-10s out of Selfridge, that it would have likely received additional KC-135 refueling tankers. So, you know, it's hard to see these cuts being made with some rejiggering of the force, because, you know, like a auto assembly plant, if you don't have the vehicle, if you don't have the plane, you know, and as you pointed out in your intro, you know, they're going to have to close bases. Without the A-10, it would make probably more attractive for the Pentagon to look at closing Selfridge as opposed to another base.
I've seen where Selfridge officials are saying that the base and its personnel kick in about $700 million to the Metro Detroit economy. So would this go down the road to closure the way, for example, Wurtsmith was closed and what happened for the Oscoda area? That was a sucker punch. What would be left for Selfridge if the A-10 is eliminated?
Well, you know, you're right. I mean, again, look at how devastating base closures were to northern Michigan and to the UP. And given the economy of Macomb County, you know, it's certainly a lot more diverse than Oscoda or the UP. But no question about it, when you're talking about 1,700 personnel at that base in Harrison Township, just the aggregate spending of all those people. I mean, those are good paying jobs, and you know, there's a lot of other large businesses that have to service the planes and keep the bases running. So it would be a very long term. If the base were to ultimately close, it would be very very negative for the area, which again goes back to why it's so difficult to close bases. And the Pentagon would say, hey, the job of the military is to protect the country, not to keep the economy humming for these states. But the reality is, when you have a defense budget that is so big and so many people are employed or directly employed by the Pentagon, it's about 2 million civilians and active duty personnel, millions more spinoff jobs, it just becomes very difficult to make cuts. And if you don't close bases, you don't get rid of vehicles, and you don't cut pay or benefits, what else can you cut, right?
Yeah. Well, let's talk politics for just a moment here. Sure. With Carl Levin, still chair of the Senate Armed Service Committee, and Representative Candace Miller, vice chair of the House Homeland Security Committee. Do you think they have the political muscle to keep these A-10s alive?
It's very interesting because, you know, Senator Levin is in his last year chairing this powerful committee, and he has always made the argument that they have to win on the basis of merit, that he has to be seen as an honest broker because in his position, he is bombarded by every senator on his committee and, frankly, all 100 senators saying, hey, we need to save X, Y, and Z. And his position for years has been, if I go out there and say I'm going to save these A-10s simply because I'm the most powerful member on military issues, you know, that basically makes him less credible. So what he has tried to do, and it was successful doing in 2012 when the last major attempt was to get rid of the A-10s at Selfridge, was, is, you know, this is why they're cost effective. This is why the plane works. This is why we think the alternative is more expensive. And so his focus has been, let's make the case like everybody else, you know, but let's not try to pull the, hey, I'm in charge of this committee and I'm just going to ram it through. You know, and Congresswoman Miller has always been a very zealous advocate, certainly using her position as well. But they've really tried to make this on the basis of not about the politics, not about the fact that the state has a lot of clout on military issues, but rather these planes are effective. They're less costly than the alternatives, and that they really are an important component of the national defense and shouldn't be cut because of that.
And then what comes next for this budget?
The Senate and the House are going to be taking up at some point the budget, and then the funding bills. Sometime over the next 3-4 months, you're going to see hearings on the A-10, certainly, and on sort of the broader proposals that the Pentagon has made, including the cuts to the National Guard, the cuts to the active duty Army. So there'll be a lot of discussion in Congress even before we get to the budget. And again, given that this is an election year, because, you know, I think it's very hard. It's very hard to cut Pentagon spending anytime, and this is just not a good year for it.
David Shepherdson, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Detroit News. Always a pleasure to talk to you, David. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Cindy. Good talking to you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Rick Snyder has been one of the most enthusiastic of America's governors in pressing Congress and the White House for immigration reform. He recently proposed a plan to attract 50,000 highly skilled immigrants to Michigan. His idea would require immigrants to live and work in bankrupt Detroit, using their skills in science, business, or the arts to help power the city back to health. But there are some who believe the governor's plan overlooks the immigrants who are already here, people who could use a little of that support. So let's talk more about what our state can do to keep the skilled immigrants who are here while attracting new ones. And what about the immigrant who might not possess an engineering or science degree, but who has energy and an entrepreneurial spirit? Are they being slighted by the governor's plan? I'm joined now by Steve Tobachman, who's director of Global Detroit. Welcome back to the program, Steve.
Thanks, Cynthia. Great to be here.
Good to have you back. And it's a pleasure to welcome Nikki Cicerani, who's president and CEO of Upwardly Global. It's a resource for skilled immigrants. Hello, Nikki.
Hi, Cynthia. Thanks for the invite.
You come from a perspective, Nikki, of trying to help skilled immigrants who are living all across the country who are unemployed and underemployed, and you try to find jobs to match their skills. In fact, you helped a husband and wife physician team who came to Ann Arbor. Tell us about them, because it gives us a good idea of what you do at Upwardly Global.
Sure. The couple that you're referring to is just one of about 1,000 skilled immigrants that Upwardly Global will serve in any given year who are in the United States, who have full work authorization, and yet, despite significant education and experience, are, as you said, either underemployed or completely unemployed. And in this case, these folks were actually doctors in their home country, and they were trying to apply for residencies in the United States. And to do that is a very specific process. It requires that one really understand what they'll be looking for in the residency applications and then in the interviews. And in many cases, those things are both technical as well as culturally specific. So much of what Upwardly Global does is help skilled immigrants who in many cases already know how to do the job. We teach them how to get the job. And so that includes everything from how to write one's resume, that would be industry-specific, crafting a cover letter, and then the role, not necessarily as applicable with residencies, but in many jobs, the role of networking, as well as how to and practice in doing a successful interview.
And they ultimately wound up in Flint, didn't they?
They absolutely did. So they both they took residencies. They were offered and took residencies in Flint, Michigan.
Steve DeBachman, we have spoken with you on this program in the past about the many ways that you feel that immigrants can help, not just Detroit, but Michigan. You're so passionate about this. And I'm wondering, we haven't talked with you since Governor Snyder's plan to bring the 50,000 immigrants to Detroit was released. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, we're excited. You know, the governor stayed the state, which was his, of course, fourth State of the State address, and the second in which he highlighted his pro-immigration economic development vision for the state happened this January, and he laid out some very specific and tangible proposals. He's creating an Office of New Americans. He's supporting a MISHTA proposal for an EB-5 Investor Visa Regional Center. And then a week later, he announced this federal policy proposal for 50,000 skilled immigrants to come to Detroit. You know, we're very excited about that proposal. We, you know, it's going to be a long road to hoe, and I don't know the chances of securing the Obama administration support for that, or whether Congress would include it in some of the federal legislation being considered. But nonetheless, it's very smart. I mean, the idea that you could get 50,000 college-educated, highly skilled people, regardless of their national origin, any metropolitan area, any city in America, that's just simply good economic policy. So we certainly support that, as we are at the same time moving forward with a variety of initiatives, including a partnership with Upwardly Global to serve immigrants who are here and to welcome additional immigrants of all shapes and sizes and all education levels.
Nikki, what were your thoughts when Governor Snyder's proposal was first put out there and you had a chance to review it? What did you like about it, first of all?
Oh, what I like is that it's recognizing that immigrants are an engine of economic development. And so we know that this is true, whether or not they're filling some of our hard-to-fill jobs in the economy or whether they're starting businesses. There's a lot of data out there now that will support how immigrants and leveraging the talents that they bring to the U.S. as well as their entrepreneurial spirit is a generator of tax revenue, consumer spending, and spillover jobs created. And so I think it's fantastic that the governor is sort of recognizing and be vocal and innovative about how to take this talent pool and make it work for the state.
What do you think was missing in your view?
Maybe just this population. There's 1.8 million immigrants in the United States today who have bachelor's and better, many of whom's backgrounds are in the STEM, healthcare, and accounting fields in which we're needing skills today for jobs that employers are saying are really hard to fill. And, you know, what we really want to do is just raise the visibility of that talent pool and offer it up as another resource. And so maybe, you know, what we hope is by putting ourselves out there and doing the show that we simply offer up another way for Michigan to tap into immigrants. And as Steve said, we already are in in our partnership doing that for Michigan. But, you know, to increasingly focus here as a near-term solution so that sometimes we don't have to wait for legislation to kick in, but we have another opportunity that maybe doesn't require sort of finagling in D.C.
Tell us about some of these other initiatives, and start with both of you telling us what you're doing in your partnership with Upwardly Global.
You know, I've been recruiting Nikki and her team to the state for 5 years, and they've been very generous with their time. We haven't secured the kind of funding that typically has brought Upwardly Global to states around the country, but really because of their interest in the economic challenges that Michigan's faced, they've been very generous to work with us and the Snyder administration to help outline the licensing requirements in 11 common professions like engineering and pharmacy and physical therapy, legal field, medical doctors, nursing, etc. And they've created an online, easy-to-use guide for foreign-trained and educated professionals. You know, the great thing about, as Nikki said, with Upwardly Global and the 1,000 people they serve is that these are great workers who are already work authorized and are already here legally and are just, you know, you can imagine the transition from another country to just getting up to speed in terms of their licensing requirements, their skills, the those kinds of things. And so we've been doing some, they've been servicing the state, which I'll let Nikki talk more about, through doing online services, doing some sample interviews, and reaching out together. We've been reaching out to employers to help break down the barriers, myths, and misunderstandings of the opportunities that already exist with skilled immigrants.
Chime in there, Nikki, because this is exciting.
Well, yeah, it's exciting for us as well. So as Steve said, you know, with the licensing guide, what we offer is a tool, but maybe to further, our online program is really the virtual version of what we've been doing in our local offices for the last 10 years. So with all the information on what's expected in a U.S. job search, how to network, industry-specific information for healthcare, engineering, resume templates and guides, as well as training, virtual training in self-paced tutorials on marketing oneself, doing a LinkedIn profile, etc. And then what's further is engaging the employer community. So we've really been fortunate in Michigan to have Steve's partnership with identifying employers who are going to be interested in signaling that they want to tap into this talent pool. And then what Upwardly Global will be doing is trying to make some of those connections locally after we know people have been through the online training and are really ready to market themselves effectively to these employers. Like we said, sort of making that market where today it might not be getting made because of gaps in the job seeker's understanding or in the employer's understanding about who this talent pool is and how to access them.
If you've just joined us, I'm talking with Nikki Cicerani. She's the president and CEO of Upwardly Global. It's a resource for skilled immigrants. And we're talking with Steve Tobachman, director of Global Detroit, as we talk about ways to tap the energy and the skills of immigrants and power Detroit and Michigan to continued economic health. And it does strike me that missing from Governor Snyder's plan, and even our conversation right now, is a significantly large group of immigrants. And these are the folks who might not have a STEM degree or a business degree or medical training, but they want to come to America. They have dreams of launching a business. So let's just say it is a grocery store, mom-and-pop business. Is there a place for these people in the Snyder plan?
Well, I don't know that there's that the 50,000 visas per se is tapping into that directly, although one of the things Upwardly Global has been great about talking about is that when we move skilled immigrants into their chosen profession in the area where they have skills, we open up jobs that they were currently occupying. So if it's a cab driver who becomes a pharmacist, what we have in the current state of affairs is some foreign trained pharmacists who are driving cabs. When that job opens up, we can employ others in that job, and that's an opportunity. But the reality is the Office of New Americans that the governor has talked about, the governor's support for initiatives that Global Detroit has helped launch, like Welcoming Michigan and the Welcome Mat Detroit, these are initiatives that are targeting working-class immigrants. And this is a critical issue for the city of Detroit. You know, we are the 18th largest city population in the country, but unfortunately we're the 135th largest city in terms of the number of immigrants. We're only 5% foreign-born, and if you took Detroit out of the equation, the rest of the region is pretty close to the national average of 13%, but because Detroit is so large and has such a small immigrant population, we see the Detroit metro area only around 8.5% to 9%. The reality is if we were the 18th largest city in terms of our foreign-born population in the city of Detroit, we'd have 108,000 additional residents, and that would be a significant economic boom. It would be a huge win for Detroit public school system, to the tax base, increased safety in neighborhoods where there'd be more eyes on the streets, and the kind of development that you've seen in southwest Detroit, Mexican Town, the mm-hmm. district that I used to represent in the state legislature, as well as in inner ring suburbs like Hamtramck and the eastern part of Dearborn, you would see more prevalent around the city. When you look at how what's happened in New York and Boston and parts of Chicago, you see that immigration is really a phenomenal revitalization tool for cities in Detroit, and that mostly occurs not necessarily through highly skilled and professional immigrants, but through working class immigrants who do bring in additional skill sets and complementary work experiences that can work alongside with native-born, you know, long-term U.S. residents to revitalize cities.
Yeah, Nikki, what's from your perspective, because you really look at this from a national perspective as you do your work with Upwardly Global, what is it about that Detroit and about Michigan that provides opportunity and also has attracted your interest?
Well, I think it's a number of things. One is that, you know, they are opening their arms and communicating to immigrants who are in the country, you know, come build here. And I think that sends a very powerful message. There, you know, we're at a time in the country where there are states that are doing quite the opposite, and they send that message both directly and through policy. And so what I love is that Michigan's really sort of tapping into this asset that's always been a driver of economic development for the country and acknowledging what immigrants have to offer, again, at a time when I think that there's a lot of negative sentiment towards immigrants.
From what you've seen and the work you've done, to each of you, what are the main misconceptions or misinformation that you find that you have to work to overcome on both parts, not only on the part of potential employers, but also immigrants?
In terms of the, you know, Governor Snyder has been great about communicating this, that, you know, immigrants make jobs. They don't take them. And where you see high levels of immigration, you see prosperity, you see rising wages, and you see larger job creation. And in fact, even among working-class African Americans, you see much lower unemployment in areas with high immigration. That's the biggest myth that we're combating, is this notion that it's a zero-sum game, that, you know, if we bring in additional people, that somehow that'll make it worse for those already here, when the reality is, look across the country, look at examples with large number of immigrants. It's actually improved the quality of life, the job opportunity, and the economy for those who were here beforehand. That's the number one myth that we combat. You know, anytime there's a news story, you look at the comments section, anytime I present publicly, those are the concerns that Michiganders have, because we've gone through such a challenging decade. It's understandable, but the reality is this is a job creator, and that's the word that we have to get out.
I'll give you the final word, Nikki.
Well, you know, I think what I would do is just encourage more innovation. It's you know, Michigan's really been out on the forefront of this, and I think other states and regions also are starting global initiatives, and I think that's a great thing. You know, what I would do is just is to say, innovate to what works locally, and then find the right partners for implementation. And you know, just this talent pool is here, and I think that it's up to us to figure out in each city or locale how we can tap into the value that they present. And I think Michigan's doing exactly the right thing by signaling nationally that Michigan's a welcoming place for immigrants.
Nikki Cicerani, Upwardly Global, and Steve Tobachman of Global Detroit, thank you so much for talking with us. It was great to get your thoughts.
Thank you.
Thanks, Cindy.
Let's hear now from one of Michigan's immigrant business owners. Jesus Valdez is from Zacatecas, Mexico. He owns and operates a shoe repair store in Ann Arbor. His story is like so many others across the state. He knew his skill was valuable, and he saw an opportunity to make his dream of owning a business a reality.
My name is Jesus Valdez, and I am the owner of Ann Arbor Shoe Repair. Well, I'm shoemaker. I started to fix shoes since I was 14 years old in Mexico City, so now I'm 60. I opened my business in July 2011. Opening my own business is something that I always wanted. When I knew that a shoe repair in downtown was closing, I said, well, this is my great opportunity. I should try hard to open my own business, because there are no other shoe repairs around. So this is my great opportunity to do so. I think it was my great desire of having my own business. Being an immigrant is certainly more difficult for the barriers of language, first, and culture differences. There is some other aspects that make it hard to run a business. I'm trying to get help from friends and some customers too, that sometimes they give me an advice. Well, I think I'm helping the economy locally, because people from other cities as far as Jackson and farther yet come here to spend money on restaurants and other businesses, because they just come here to fix their shoes. There's in some places they don't have shoe repairs around there, so they come here and they have heard about me, so they come just to fix their shoes. I hope immigrants I will tell them that this is a great country with a lot of opportunities, and they should take theirs and don't let them pass by.
Welcome back to Stateside. When Governor Snyder pushed through a repeal of the PPT, the personal property tax, in late 2012, it was seen as a good step towards encouraging businesses to set up and expand in Michigan. But local governments took it right on the chin. Many were in line to lose a significant source of revenue as the PPT was phased out. But there was good news for municipal officials who are worried about that great big hole in their budgets. A package of bills is now working its way through the legislature to plug the hole without having to revert to anything like the PPT, which Governor Snyder called the second dumbest tax in Michigan. And even better news, this package seems to have just about everybody on board, including both Democratic and Republican lawmakers. Here to tell us more is Kathleen Gray from the Detroit Free Press Lansing Bureau. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Cindy. How are you?
Good to have you with us. And we always are glad to welcome MLive's Capitol reporter, Jonathan Oesting. Hello, Jonathan.
Hey, Cindy. Thanks for having me.
Sure enough. Kathy, start with giving us a refresher on the PPT and why the governor called it the second dumbest tax in Michigan, right behind the Michigan business tax, which, of course, he chucked in his first year in office.
Well, the tax is a tax on equipment. It's a tax on office furniture. It's a tax basically on businesses and what they have to use to do their business. And people saw that as just a real disincentive for companies to invest in new equipment, invest in new office furniture, invest in all different sorts of things. So there was a real push to kill the PPT. However, communities have just been hammered. They've lost $6 billion, that's billion with a B, in revenue sharing over the last decade. They're also losing a ton of property tax revenues because of the housing bubble that happened. So if they eliminated this, it would really, really hurt a lot of communities. And when they passed this bill back in 2012, there wasn't assurances that there would be a replacement revenue for the communities that get the personal property tax.
And some of these communities really got hit hard, the ones that had a lot of businesses in them. If they were a bedroom community, maybe not so much?
Well, I mean, look at a community like eCourse, has lots of manufacturing. The personal property tax accounted for 45.8% of their budget. River Rouge, it's 56% of their budget. Ypsilanti, it's 6.5% for the city of Ypsilanti. You know, so yeah, the communities that have businesses and manufacturing facilities are really hurt hard by this.
So, Jonathan Oesting, it appears lawmakers have heard the howls of pain from the municipalities. What have they come up with to plug that hole in local government budgets?
Sure. Well, they've not only heard the howls, but they're also looking at the ballot in 2014.
There's that.
The replacement revenue portion is going to be put before voters. So they were expecting opposition from municipal leaders, et cetera, if they didn't address this issue. So what they're doing, what they're proposing, is setting aside a larger share of the state's use tax, which is applied to out-of-state purchases. We're supposed to pay this when we make internet purchases, for instance, although a lot of people don't. So they're going to set aside a larger portion of the use tax to make up for some of the lost revenue. And there's also going to be a statewide assessment for businesses that are newly exempt from the PPT. Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly said he expects still businesses to save about 80% over what they were paying previously under the PPT, and at the same time reimburse local communities for all the money that they would have lost under this repeal, which is being phased in slowly.
So the package would plug 100% of the budget hole left from repealing the PPT?
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. The use tax, it wouldn't be a percentage of the use tax. So it wouldn't grow or shrink the amount of revenue they're sending to municipalities. Cali said they've actually settled on a dollar figure for each community that would be appropriate, matching the amounts that they were receiving previously.
And, Kathy, the businesses then paying this tax, it is not as big a hit as the old PPT was for them, right?
Right, it's not. And as much as the tax itself it was for them, it's the administration of it. It's a very, very convoluted tax that has lots of different formulas and stuff like that. So it was a bureaucratic nightmare, not only for the businesses, but for the communities who had to collect it.
So I'm curious, who's on board for this tweaking? Who's supporting this?
You name it. Just about everybody is.
Yeah. As you mentioned, you're open to just about everybody. As I was discussing, it's going to be on the ballot. So there was real fear that an organization like the Michigan Municipal League would oppose it. And if they did oppose the replacement revenue portion, it could actually undo the entire PPT repeal. There was a real desire by the administration here to get everybody on board. Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly led these talks for about a year and a half, involving small businesses, large businesses, county associations, municipal league. So pretty much everybody who needed a seat at the table seemed to be there.
And it was fairly unusual. You don't see a press conference that has both Republicans and Democrats from both the House and the Senate. And yesterday when they had this press conference to announce the compromise, both Republicans and Democrats were on board as well.
Well, in fact, let's go into that a little bit from both of you. How often is it as Capitol reporters when you have everybody kind of singing from the same page in the hymnal?
On little bills, there's usually pretty widespread support, but on these big things, you're always going to find some dissent, and it doesn't seem to be there.
Sure. I think a lot of, as Senator Rebecca Warren said yesterday, a lot of Democrats didn't really like the PPT either, but they ended up voting against the plan that passed in 2012 because of these fears over, the dollars sent to communities. A lot of communities, same thing. They didn't really love the PPT either because it discouraged business growth in their community. But, they weren't really willing to get on board with a plan that was going to hurt their bottom line either. This seemed to satisfy both sides of the aisle and both sides of the business community debate as well.
Giving some idea of the kinds of municipal services that would be hurt, where the money was going to be lost, and oh hooray, it looks like it'll come back again. What were cities going to have to do without because of the PPT repeal?
Well, the initial bill that passed had some provisions in there for essential services, police, fire, that type of thing. But the other things that would be lost at the time would be, parks and rec, those types of things, the things that are deemed non-essential. This new version deals with everything. The assessment that is going to be put on businesses is supposed to be for essential services. So there will be a steady funding stream definitely for police and fire. And if there's full replacement, 100% replacement, then everything else that your community does should be able to receive the funding.
So how quickly might we expect to see this thing get through both the Senate and the House, Jonathan?
Sounds like it's going to move very quickly. The Senate Finance Committee is actually taking it up in about 20 minutes, so one day after it was introduced. There's a procedural five-day rule, meaning that the Senate can't actually vote on it until next week, so they'll probably do that Tuesday. And the House expects to complete the work at some point in March. They hope to send it to the governor's desk by the end of next month.
And that would be in plenty of time to have all the ruffled feathers smoothed in time for voters to go to the polls in August and say yes to replacing that revenue with the 6% use tax.
Yeah, and they also have to change the language that will be before voters as well on the ballot proposal. So there's a number of reasons why it's essential to get it done quickly, and it looks like they're going to.
Well, it isn't often we can say somebody something that's happening in the legislature is win-win for everybody, and we've got everybody on board. So it would be nice to see more of that. I think we can all agree.
Knock on wood.
Kathy Gray of the Detroit Free Press, Jonathan Osting of MLive, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And we have an update. As Jonathan predicted, the Senate Finance Committee ended up unanimously passing the package, and it now goes to the full Senate for a vote next week. One of Detroit's many great challenges could also turn out to be a great opportunity to figure out how to imagine big cities that are more livable, more walkable, and more sustainable. The challenge, all those large parcels of empty land, abandoned, unpaved, unloved, not generating much of anything, especially not revenue. But my next guest sees those parcels as something that could hold the key to a better American city. Joshua Newell is an assistant professor at the University of Michigan's School of Natural Resources. Joshua, you and your team are looking for ways to turn this urban wasteland into productive green spaces. Is this goal truly reachable?
I hope so. I know there's a lot of folks working on this issue, and I think there's a lot more hopefulness than there has been in the past with respect to Detroit. So I'm really positive, and I think that we're gaining a lot of momentum in terms of kind of recreating and redeveloping Detroit so that it's once again a great American city.
What's the basis for this kind of new sense of hopefulness, do you think?
Well, I think there have been a lot of changes politically in Detroit. I think that there's a lot more investment moving into Detroit. I think there's a growing awareness nationally that there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of land in Detroit that could be repurposed for more productive, creative, and sustainable uses.
You and your team have some research efforts that are ongoing in Detroit, and I was real interested in the project that has you studying and mapping the way people walk through unpaved, abandoned lots. So what do you learn from the pedestrians that you think could help policymakers and planners?
Yeah, it turns out there's actually thousands of miles of these urban footpaths that crisscross the city. And you're able to see them through Google Earth and other technologies because they're on vacant land, and so it's permeable surface. So it's unlike concrete where you can't see them. So it's clear that people are using these footpaths for a variety of purposes, to go to school, to go to the store, from home to work in some cases. And so we feel that this is a really important piece of the urban fabric, and it enhances mobility. If these footpaths are preserved, so we're actually mapping them using mm-hmm. Google Earth, and we're using a number of social science methods to capture more fully how people are actually using these footpaths. But most of them are on so-called vacant land, mm-hmm. so they're actually this so-called vacant land is actually being used. And so as Detroit redevelops, as planning agencies figure out what to do with a lot of this land, we think that preserving some of the most important footpaths is a really important part of the new Detroit.
So basically, people are having their way with a layout that was planned a century or so ago. And here it is. It's 2014. Here's how we want to use the land. And so you're trying to almost catch up the design with the use?
Yeah. Most cities are often designed for the automobile. Mm-hmm. And in some sense, it's a failure of traditional engineering. But these footpaths clearly are a more efficient way to get from point A to point B in many cases.
And would the idea be that as these vacant, grassy lots get used in some way, that you would try to also figure out how pedestrians are using that and work around that and accommodate them?
Yeah, and to formalize some of them actually mm-hmm. as active footpaths, sort of like we have greenways in Detroit mm-hmm. now. We think the same could happen with footpaths. And then you could actually repurpose some of these so-called vacant spaces where you could have footpaths and urban gardens and play spaces. So you're actually formalizing, creating them, legitimizing them, if you will, so that they do enhance mobility and walkability in our great city.
I'm speaking with University of Michigan Professor Joshua Newell with the School of Natural Resources, and he and his team are looking for ways to turn urban wasteland into productive green spaces. And Joshua, another study that you're really doing is trying to figure out what you can do with these vacant parcels of mm-hmm. land. Talk to us about what you're examining and what you're learning.
Well, we're looking at all sorts of ways to transform this vacant land, one of which is, of course, these footpaths. Mm-hmm. The other is urban agriculture. So we're using Google Earth to map urban gardens in an area of Detroit, the Lower East Side specifically. And we've documented a large number of urban gardens, and we're trying to get a better sense of what types of food people are growing, what is the spatial extent of these gardens. It turns out that most of these gardens, in fact, are on vacant land. So there actually are, a lot of this land is already being used. We're also looking at green infrastructure as a way to use this vacant land. So we have a lot of stormwater issues in Detroit. Mm-hmm. And so green infrastructure is a way to capture some of this stormwater, especially during heavy rains. And that actually green infrastructure can be integrated with other forms of land use, such as urban agriculture. And we hope foot paths as well.
So it certainly seems like the technology has gotten you to a point where you could not have been 10 years ago, 15 years ago. How would you have ever been able to cover that 160 square miles, some of the city of Detroit? But with Google Earth, that really is a powerful tool for you and your researchers.
It sure is indeed. It's incredibly powerful. It would take years to do what we're doing in a matter of 6 months.
Now, do you expect that what you're going to learn in Detroit will be applicable to major American cities?
Certainly in parts of the post-industrial Midwest, mm-hmm. absolutely. Obviously in places like Los Angeles, where it's almost entirely impervious surface, right. you're not going to be able to see that many footpaths, although there are some if you look in Google Earth. But we see this as an innovative use of a technology and also a very interesting aspect of human use of the built environment that has gone unnoticed so far. We've really found very little research on footpaths.
Huh.
In landscape architecture, they also call them desire lines.
Do you think it is truly possible that we as a society, we as people, are willing to change the way that we've lived in cities for centuries? Because it sounds like that's where things are moving or need to move. But are we collectively willing to make that change?
I hope so. As we're all becoming more and more aware of the importance of sustainability, I think that we can change and that many of us are trying to. More than half the world lives in cities now, so cities are really a leverage point for change. And I think that there's growing awareness that for global sustainability, we have to transform our cities, and that includes the way we walk through our cities.
And if we don't get our collective act together when it comes to reimagining how we're going to live in cities, what do you fear?
Well, I work on cities because I think they really do hold a key to global sustainability. And I fear without a large-scale transformation, which is potential in Detroit, that we really face some very steep challenges with respect to climate change, with respect to biodiversity loss, with respect to the health of our forests. We really are major consumers as urban dwellers, and therefore we owe it to the planet to rethink how we obtain our food, how we get from home to school, and I think we have a duty to do so.
Joshua Newell is an assistant professor at the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources. He and his team are currently engaged in mapping footpaths through the uncut, grassy, unused lots of Detroit and learning a lot. It feels like you're, in a sense, kind of pioneers. As I said, the circle has kind of come around again, and now you can hopefully set a new course.
Thank you.
And that's our show for this Wednesday. Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Our contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisgetter, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio. It's a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.